Hey, y'all. I'm Allison Asarch from Nashville, Tennessee.
Hey, I'm Sean Fraser from the Ritzy Kids.
Hunters, this is Johnny from Rail Motor.
Hey, it's Shane from Blind Season.
Hey, it's Rob Stanier, and you can check out my music on all the streaming platforms.
Check out my latest music on all the streaming sites.
Check out my debut album on all streaming platforms.
Check out our new debut album.
Check us out on Spotify and Apple Music. And you're listening to our friends, Braggy and Curly.
My favorite bands from Australia.
My two favorite podcasts is Braggy and Curly.
Braggy and Curly.
On the
Unfiltered Undiscovered Podcast.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to episode 128 of the Unfiltered and Undiscovered Podcast. We've got a very special guest with us today. We've got Jordan Merrick, another Brisbane, Queensland boy here, Rossi. So you are definitely outnumbered again. So, and we're going to be talking all things Jordan in just a short tick. But in the meantime, Braggy, Rossi, how are you both? And I know that, and even Jordan's itching to talk about some cricket. So how was that effort by the Aussies?
Mate, what, like, I'm with Jordan, like, finally I can get some sleep now.
I'm still tired.
I don't think I've seen a better fielding performance just straight off the bat.
Yeah, I just love the way these guys... You know, that everyone criticised Cummings right back at the start, you know, because he's a greenie, which is great. I like that. And all the old school guys are up him about that. And then they said, oh, a fast bowler can't be captain. And these guys have just been away for so long. And just to bring them together, like they've made the leap from good team to great team.
World Test champions, Ashes champions, 20 ODI champions. It's hard to be a better side.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they've done it not like all those, not that I don't like the other old school Australian teams, but they've, I love all those guys, but they've done it without the sledging and without the beer swilling and all that sort of stuff, you know?
Not that there's anything wrong with beer swilling and sledging.
That's true.
What would this podcast be without a little bit of sledging?
That's right. But you know who reminds, and you older guys will know who this, what I'm talking about. Cummings' captaincy reminds me of John Eales, the Wallaby captain from back in the 90s. He was a forward, and they said, oh, you can't have a forward as a captain.
And
he just quietly went about his business, won two World Cups. Thank you.
Yeah.
Personally, I find him to be a little bit like Jared Warrior Hargraves.
Oh, Rossi.
You had to bring the Roosters into it, didn't you, Rossi? So unbelievable. And the other big news on the podcast, of course, is that there's been two birthdays since our last episode. Braggy had one on the 17th of November. Yes. How was your birthday? Good day, mate.
Very good day. My wife took me to lunch. So that's all I can ask for.
That is all you need.
And one more trip around the sun and I can get free public transport in South Australia. Looking forward to that. I am going to be bussing the fuck out of everything.
You get one of those really cool McDonald's seniors cards.
Yeah.
Get the free coffee.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Oh, so there is a benefit to aging. All right. Well done. And I joined you with a trip around the sun on Monday. So I had a great birthday as well. So
excellent.
Fantastic day.
Went down. Sporting, how is your foot too?
Oh, it's still in a boot, but it'll get there. I've got December 7 is the day that I start running again. So I've got a couple of weeks still up the sleeve. So we'll see how that one goes. Hey, during the week, some great news out of one of our guests, Laura Frank, episode 115 and 125, I think, was she's a finalist in two categories in the 2024 Australian Country Music People's Choice Awards at, and I'm presuming it's Tamworth in January. So she's been named a finalist in Best Female Vocal. That is just amazing. That's incredible. Yeah. And her song, Hey Cowboy, is named in the Best Song category. So well done, Laura.
She's a hard worker, man.
those guys.
You know her, yeah. Jordan?
Yeah, I do. We did a, funnily enough, a Halloween event together a few weeks ago. So, we were the odd ones out there, only two who weren't dressed as vampires or zombies or something. But, yeah, no, she's a legend.
Yeah, because she's on that tour at the moment, isn't she, with, like, throughout doing the showgrounds all the way around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
800,000 gigs, isn't it? It's something like that.
It's 60 gigs or something. Yeah. Unbelievable. But fantastic news, and it'll be so cool if she can pick a winner. I'm going to back her in. So,
yep.
And
she's got our vote. She's got all our vote unanimous.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. So well done, Laura Frank. And without any further ado, let's have a quick introduction to our special guest, all the way from Brisbane. He's been heralded as Brisbane's Bob Dylan. So so that's something that we
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. Occupying that middle ground between folk and blues rock. Let's welcome to the show. We've got Jordan Merrick. How are you, Jordan?
Good, good. Nah, thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's good. Jordan, we usually start with the first questions. Usually, I usually take it as, because I always like to know how music came into your life. So, were your folks musical, or did you just pick it up out of the blue? You listen to the radio? How did it all start?
Yeah, no, definitely. My folks definitely weren't musical. They used to, and I still don't really know why this was a saying in my family, but my granddad, like, one of my, no joke, earliest memories is he used to say, there are no musical Merricks. And I just, it's the weirdest, honest, I'm not even kidding. Just imagine like an old man, like I would see him like twice a year. We'd just drive around Australia and that would somehow be said every trip. Maybe it was like subliminal wanting to like, rebel against him. But my parents, like both of them love music and listen to music, but yeah, none of them played. It was just sort of through the radio listening to some music. And then I found my sister bought a guitar once and just didn't really use it, just sat in the garage, and then found it when I was sort of going through the garage and thought, you know what, I'm going to try to learn a song. And one thing led to another, just fell in love with it, you know. It was just as lucky as that, really.
I just had a vision when you were saying, there's no musical Merricks, and I just had that vision of that old cartoony character, old fella, just randomly saying that to trees and whatever they come across in the backyard.
Grandpa Simpson.
That would honestly be him. I remember as a kid, I used to have this idea of a stereotypical old man. I think it's probably from cartoons, where like a full night, like nighty, and like a little sleeping hat. And I remember one time he pulled into the driveway and he was sleeping in his camper van. And I went to visit him in the morning. I knocked on his door and he opens the door. He literally had one of those sleeping hats on. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that was actually a thing. So, no, he definitely ticked the classic old man vibe in that way.
Something for us all to aspire to.
Oh yeah.
Honestly, hence why I wear a hat. I figure I've got to work myself to the old man sleeping hat. I'm nearly there, you know.
Oh, Braggy's almost there with his free public transport.
Yeah.
I feel like when you turn, how old is it? 60, 50?
60, you're going to be 60 next year, yeah. 60.
So. I feel like it should come with the free public transport and the sleeping hat. Just look you up. In your set, yeah.
And maybe one of those little plates with a candle on it.
Yeah. And the lantern. You no longer use electricity, I'm sorry to say. So.
Yeah.
You go, Curly.
Oh, sorry. Jordan, how does it feel being described as Brisbane's Bob Dylan?
Oh, look, it's definitely it's a compliment I'll take. I think it's always funny when you get compared to someone, like anyone, let alone the greatest of all time. But yeah, I sort of honestly, it's a nice compliment, but I sort of, you know, I'm just, you're just yourself, right? I guess because when they made that reference, I think I just released pretty traditionally styled folk songs. So probably, you know, you think traditional folk, who's a folk artist? Everyone's mind goes to Dylan. So I'll definitely take it. But yeah, look, I got a long way to go before I really can be compared to him, I think.
He'd definitely be an influence of yours, as well as probably Nick Cave, I'm thinking, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. I love them both. Yeah, I think when I got into songwriting, because I didn't listen to Dylan or Nick Cave or anyone growing up. Mm. I think it was more when I got a bit older and literally I think I was about 16 and I heard Bob Dylan's song Desolation Row and I was just blown away. I was like, this guy's lyrics, how the hell is he writing such good words? And I looked at my crappy little, I think I was writing, you know, dumb teenage love songs. I was thinking, this is shit. What am I doing? I got a long way to go to be good at this. So I pretty much just said, okay, Dylan's the best. So I just went all in on listening to him and trying to learn as much as I could from his music. And then, you know, as you said, you then find Nick Cave and, you know, Leonard Cohen, Tom Waits, just, you know, the list goes on of amazing songwriters and, you know, they're the ones you learn from more than anything. You don't need to take a course. You just listen to what's been done and try to take it in, really.
Yeah, exactly. Well said. And it's, the reason I said Nick Cave is because a lot of songs seem really, really haunting. And I'm just talking about the whole album we haven't got because we're going to talk about painting, aren't we, first? Curly, is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. But the painting is the new one.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the I was just going to say the album sound, a lot of the songs sound really haunting to me, really that real Nick Cavey voice. Or I don't know, I'll keep describing it, like comparing it to other people, which is unfair. But I don't know if you've heard of there was a movement in the early 70s there, outlaw country, and guys like Townes Van Zandt, who I love his lyrics and some of that stuff.
Yeah,
reminded me of that.
Yeah, I love Townes Van Zandt.
Yeah.
As I was listening to, you know, the painting and a couple of those other tracks, it's the Woody Guthrie side of Dylan that I was hearing. Yeah, it's the Woody Guthrie side. Yeah. But that, yeah, and so like the painting, you know, when I saw that sort of Namat Jira style traditional Australian painting, it's like, yeah, sort of. I started to tap into it through there as well.
So is that's your dad's painting, yeah, that you're singing about?
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah.
My take on what you're writing about, tell me if I'm wrong, so your dad painted, I guess, in his spare time, did he? He didn't have a chance to follow it.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't think he really had much of a desire to either. And I don't really know because, I mean, I think something like the arts, even when I was growing up, was always seen like, oh, it's a nice hobby. What are you going to go and study in uni, you know? That was pretty much the extent of the arts when I was growing up and thinking, I want to do this for a living. You never think you really should chase it because no one really tells you that you should, you know? Mm. So I can only imagine it was probably much the same when he was painting. You know, my granddad, the one who wore the hat.
Merrick's art pages.
Well, no artists in this family.
Well, my granddad used to paint, and he was a really good painter too.
Okay.
So I think my dad took up painting because of his dad. I haven't asked him that, but I can only assume. But yeah, I don't know why he stopped. He just stopped. I think he only did it for a period of his life, and then I definitely wasn't painting when I was a kid. So I think he just it was one of those things that he just probably really enjoyed doing. And then, you know, when you have kids and have a job that takes up a lot of your time, and you get different, you know, you find different things that you want to do with your life falls by the wayside. So, but yeah, I do. Yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it? Like, you know, who knows if he would have kept pursuing it. You know, as if it was seen as a viable pathway, because some of the paintings he did was beautiful, and just I was very lucky to find it in the storage unit after that much time that it wasn't in bad shape at all.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's such an amazing way to start a song, but with that whole metaphorical thing of I fell into a painting, you know,
fell into a painting my father gave to me. It told me a story of a life he didn't see.
For the blue of the sky matched the veins to his heart, and tears down his face when his world ceased to start. And the browns of his road like the dirt on his feet, from a life well walked despite walking in defeat. The painting was like quicksand, I sunk down to my knees and took in a deep breath beneath the eucalyptus trees. The wind danced upon my face and sung for lonely men. It was here in the nameless the dream began to end. I tried to yell on out, words roll like a sphere, but his word was made for silence and mine was made to hear. For he played the game of dreamers and drowned in his resolve, and said life ain't for dreaming, there's too much risk involved. For the world that we create, the great gift of lies, rather sell my soul to hate. And
there's a, yeah,
there's a book, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of a book called Weave World by Clive Barker. It's a sci-fi thing, it goes way back. It's a story of a guy that falls into a carpet, like an unrolled carpet, and there's a world in there. Just, yeah, it's interesting metaphor what you've done.
Yeah, well, it was interesting when I wrote this song. It was sort of a bit like that was the moment. It felt like falling into it, because it was, yeah, it was right after I finished my second album's release and like shows and stuff, and you know, it was still, you know, smack bang in the pandemic. So as I'm sure I don't need to tell you guys, the music industry was you know, torn to shit in that time. So it was yeah, it was a very exhausting time, and it wasn't very enjoyable, if I'm being honest. And I sort of thought, you know, where to from here? You know, what's next? Do I even really want to do any more recordings? And yeah, I was literally just literally sitting in this room. It's actually the painting literally just on the wall over there. So it literally is in here.
That's cool.
It hangs out in here, I think. But yeah, I was just literally sitting here and looking at it, and just sort of, you know, falling into sort of that thought pattern of you know, my dad when he was painting this, and you know, thinking about, you know, that it was a shame that he stopped painting. And then I sort of related to my life and thought, you know, if I stop doing music, like, what's that going to look like? You know, what am I going to be thinking about 10, 20, 30 years time? Will I regret it? And the answer was absolutely, you know. So it sort of got me on a really big train of thought. And I think when I got out of that, I thought, you know, I want to try to write a poem about this moment and about the painting. And then, yeah, thankfully it fit to some music and it ended up on the album.
So when you say you wrote a poem, do you think you write lyrics standalone and then put them to music? Is that part of your process? Like, or what is your process?
Yeah, to be honest, I never really write like that. It's very rare that I'll ever just do lyrics. I'll write a poem and then try to put it to music. A lot of the times, if I'm writing lyrics and I don't have an instrument with me, I'll sort of think about the melody, which you know, you can sort of get an idea of how it'll sound. Then you've just got to try to work out how to play it on the guitar or something. But normally I'll always write with at least, you know, the melody in mind or the idea of the song in mind. But this was literally just a flat out poem that I thought, you know, oh, it's a shame it's no music. I was like, I've got to try to do something with it, because I'm certainly not pumping out a poetry book or anything like that anytime soon. So yeah, no, I'm definitely glad it worked out.
Okay. You seem to be pretty prolific writer. If you've, yeah. So how long ago were the other two albums?
So I did, album one was 2019.
Okay.
Album two, 2021. So basically one every 2 years.
Yeah.
And I did a couple of EPs in 2017 as well. So that was probably the start of the solo sort of journey for me. But yeah, no, I it's probably a good thing. Like, I'm a bit of a, you know, you go through periods of time where you just a bit reclusive, and you do a lot of like watching of movies, reading, and then writing. So I've always been like that ever since, you know, high school. Like I still, you know, do go out a lot, but me and my sister is a bit the same. We always joke that we're the most antisocial social people that we know, in the sense that we sort of always like to have a lot of time to ourselves. But so with it, like I've just always honestly got into the habit of writing for the longest time. And even before I was doing music, I was a young kid, I used to love writing short stories. So writing is always just something I've just loved to do. It gives me a lot of joy. So with songwriting, I love to write. So it's like a therapy for me as well as anything. So
excellent. So I'm gonna jump in here because Braggy, it's time for part one of your Who Am I?
So I did a really hard one last week, so I thought I'd bracket up with a bit of an easy one.
Oh, thank you.
That's okay. So,
Jared. He says that now.
Hey?
He says that now.
I got a feeling that Rossi will get this in the first section, but we'll see. If you do, Rossi, okay. don't say who it is if you know. I was born on the 8th of January, 1947 in Brixton, London. Narrows it down, doesn't it? My father worked as a promotions officer for children's charity Barnardo's, and my mother was a waitress at a cinema in Kent. I went to Stockwell Infant School until I was 6 years old, acquiring a reputation as a gifted, single-minded child and a defiant brawler. In 1953, my family moved to Sunridge Park, where I attended Burnt Ash Junior School. My voice was considered adequate by the school choir, and I demonstrated above average abilities in playing the recorder, Curly. At the age of 9, my dancing during the newly introduced music and movement classes was strikingly imaginative. Teachers called my interpretations vividly artistic and my poise astonishing for a child. The same year, my interest in music was further stimulated when my father brought home a collection of American 45s by artists including Fats Domino, Elvis Presley, and Little Richard. By 1956, I'd taken up the ukulele and the T-chess bass, begun to participate in skiffle sessions with friends, and started to play the piano. Anybody?
No, not yet.
Got to make it hard to start. But it's that era, isn't it, where it could be one of 1,000 guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Skiffle throws me.
Ukulele throws me.
Yeah, me too. And a brewing tea chest.
Yeah, being born in Brixton throws me. I mean, just everything that Braggy just said throws me. Hey, Jordan, let's talk a little bit about albums because we constantly have discussions with artists who are putting out their singles, single by single and both single, but you've got three clear albums in your repertoire. So why the album, and what's your thoughts around this whole single drip feeding music scenario that we now have?
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely an interesting talking point. So I guess for me, the why album is I love listening to albums. For me, when as a listener, you know, whether it's a record or just, you know, streaming or whatever, CDs, I think it's so good listening to a collection together. And I think as well, something that I particularly started to appreciate about albums more when I got into buying vinyls is just the thought that goes into the structuring of an album. And you know, even if their songs aren't particularly linked, you know, there's still a narrative flow that happens, you know, on the side A and the side B. So for me, I love that. I love diving in and listening and re-listening. And I think you get such a different experience to listening to a single song. So that's why albums for me, I love albums. And I think when I make music, you know, I want to try to replicate what I love. And for me, it's just, the full body of work. I think, is you know, a big part of that. Even an EP, you know, you can do a lot with five songs. I think you can do a hell of a lot more than with one song. So yeah, so that's probably why albums for me more than anything. It's not because it's the smart choice. The smart choice is definitely doing the drip feeding of singles, because they're a lot cheaper, they're a lot easier to manage. You know, there's a lot of benefits from that regard. And I think, you know, talking about the good old algorithm, you know, the thing that runs the world these days, you know, content is king. So a lot of people will just do singles because it's just extra content that you can keep pushing all year. You know, if you have 10 songs, one song a month, that's 10 months of content, you know, in theory. But, you know, I get why people would do that. I really do. For me, though, I just, yeah, I love albums, so I'm a sucker for it, against probably my better judgment, but, you know.
What's your favourite format to release in?
Oh, vinyl. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing quite like it. It's yeah, it's funny, you know. It's, I guess, you know, when I was probably in my early 20s, I didn't like buy records or anything. I honestly thought it was a bit gimmicky. I thought, you know, oh, they're coming back, these old school things. It's not as convenient as the CD or the MP3. And then actually, it was one of my bandmates bought me a recorder, one of those really, you know, those cheap portable record players you can get. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's cool. That's a nice gift. And I listened to it. I was like, man, it's such a, then you turn the record over and I was like, oh, I need to get another record. And then you begin. And then I was exactly what I feared, you know. But I think, honestly, you know, I thought it was super gimmicky. But then, yeah, it really gave me a completely new appreciation of music and album, the form of an album as well. So, no, I'm all for them. So, yeah, even though they're expensive.
Yeah, it's the whole ceremony of putting an album on, of, you know, giving it, wiping it down first, you know, making sure the needle's got no dust on it, then getting up and turning it over and say, okay, that's act one. What's act two?
Yeah. You almost described a night at Braggy's place with that whole experience that you had. So, so with the latest album, it's called Winner Take Nothing. Help me understand the title.
Yeah, sure. So it's named after an Ernest Hemingway book. He did a novella called Winner Take Nothing. And yeah, it was so the reason I sort of named it after the book was a couple of reasons, but so I wrote a song on the album called Song for a Room, and
can I just say that that's the lyric that I want to bring up? The machine that kills fascists was killed by the algorithmic blues. Okay, that's what a great opening line for a song. I don't know if you listened to that one, Curly. Did you get that far, Curly?
I can't recall. So
and we're back at Woody Guthrie. Guthrie.
Song for a room.
I did get to that. Yes, I did.
Sorry to interrupt, Jordan. Go.
No, so when I was writing that song, and like, you know, sometimes when you're writing lyrics, it's just rambling, and then you try to make sense of what you'd written. And that was sort of like that song in a big way. And the lyric that where I referenced that book, when I was going back through the lyrics, I was like, why the hell did I bring up that novella that I read years ago? It was just such a subconscious thing. And then I was sort of going through this literally sitting in the studio, you know, I think halfway through recording, trying to work out what the name of this album was going to be. And I just kept coming back to that line in the song. So I thought, you know what, when I get out of the studio, I'm going to get the book and read it again, because it had been, God, 10 years since I'd read it. And, yeah, it's a really great set of short stories. It was written sort of just after the First World War, and sort of is presented in a way of society coming out of such a, you know,
horrific
dark period of, yeah, a crazy period of time, and people had to rediscover what it was like to be a human and sort of reintegrate into a normal world. You know, it's such a well-written set of short stories, and I thought, you know, oh, you know, relating that to the album. The album was written sort of coming out of the pandemic, and in a lot of ways it was, you know, exploring, you know, I suppose as well, you know, going and doing the album during the pandemic, that was all recorded literally in the room I'm in now, like my little home studio, outside of the drums, which I got literally done overseas. So it was such an impersonal way of making records. Like, there was no community to it. It was just me, like, you know, smashing a keyboard or playing the guitar. So then, you know, this album was going into the studio with the full band again for the first time in years, and doing it in person, being able to, you know, we live track the album at a studio called Airlock Studios in Sanford. And the great thing about that room is everyone can be in the room together, because the way they've set the room up, you can have all the sounds isolated but everyone together. And it was such a good experience, and it was like coming out of this crazy period of time and into the world again in a way. So yeah, when I was sort of going through the album titles, I felt like, you know, my subconscious was probably trying to tell me something with referencing the book, and it just felt like a really fitting title, all things considered. So, yeah.
There seems to be a couple of songs on there that are kind of like Two Hands, which I guess is like a comment on the good and the evil that humans are capable of.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah, and it's interesting with Two Hands, because I know we've talked about your influences, but I, funnily enough, hear hints of Dave Graney in that one. So just there's a little bit of a stutter there, what I would call a bit of a stutter, as the music sort of it feels a bit awkward, you know, and the Graney's the master at that, creating these, crafting these pop songs that are just not quite, you're sort of just a little bit behind or a little in front, and I'm thinking, there's Dave Graney there. So I don't know if you know Dave Graney.
Two hands take away your sins. Two hands done before the show begins. Two hands giving at charity. Two hands are lifting me up from my knees. Two hands going crazy like sharpeners in guns. Two hands reaching for the sun. If I could only tell which way we will fall. Well, two hands around my waistband. Two hands are going to Mars. Two hands are breaking my heart.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I didn't actually know him until this year. So it's funny to mention that, because yeah, I can definitely see where you're coming from. But yeah, certainly. What a guy. What a musician.
It's got a groove to it, that one, Two Hands as well.
Yeah, it has.
My wife asked me, she notoriously doesn't like Bob Dylan. it's like an in-family joke. Anyway, but she doesn't like Bob Dylan. And she asked me, who's on the podcast tonight? I said, you won't like it. She said, why not? She said, and so I just played her Two Hands, and she goes, I love this song, and started moving. So
there you go. So you can move it over.
Oh, no, it's a funny one. And you know like what it's like, you know, and it's like everyone does it. We all look for people to, you know, oh, this looks like this person or reminds me of this singer, you know. So, you know, definitely I'll take it. But it's like, it's one of those things you just, you don't even really think. Yeah, exactly. You know, if people want to say, they can say what they want, you know. I don't really mind.
You get hit with a label and it follows you around like a bad smell. You just can't get rid of it.
Yeah, speaking like of a band buckle or something.
Yeah. Oh, good one.
Oh, Jordan, you can come back.
Jordan Merritt's his name. Jordan Merritt.
So, speaking of labels, so your producer, Cody McWaters, produced the Chats. Now, I don't know about you, Rossi, but I don't think there's a really close connection there between the Chats and what Jordan's putting out.
Well, Jordan hasn't got red hair.
thank you. That's the main difference, really. Yeah.
So what was it like working with Cody?
Yeah, Cody's great. I've known him for a while now, and he mixed the last album of mine. Yeah. But this was the first time we could record together. But no, he's fantastic. What I really love about working with Cody is, you know, different producers have different ways they approach, you know, recording. Whereas the way I am as an artist, I suppose I've grown into over the years is I loved it just to be able to be creative and just see how it turns out. So, in other words, don't record a part, then re-record it over and over again. Just let the tape run, you know, and record it. Let yourself get into the moment, and then that's when the magic happens. It's not trying to be too perfect. I mean, I guess if you're doing pop music or whatever, you know, that might be the approach, but not for this sort of stuff, you know. And I think Cody really has that same mindset as well. It's let artists be artists, let creative people be creative idiots, you know. You know, that's where the magic happens. And he's just sort of there to capture it and make sure it is in time and is usable. And if it is, then great, it's fantastic. If it's not, then hey, we can fix it up. But he gave us a lot of creative freedom. And then just help steer the ship as well, you know, like let's try this thing, or maybe we should do another guitar part here and layer this part. See if it works. So he would have, you know, good suggestions. He never wanted to overload the songs. Like, we went in with the idea of making it feel like a live album. And so we took that and we sort of just ran with it, and he just allowed us to do it. I suppose just to play, which sometimes is a lot easier said than done when you're dealing with, you know, producers and musicians in general. You know, sometimes it's hard to know when to play and hard to know when to just let it breathe, you know. So now he's a great person to work with.
So those guys, are they the guys you recorded that album with? Are they like your road band, or are they session players? Or
So they're my road band, but I honestly, like, I feel it's the Jordan Merrick album and what have you, but you know, I just the band has been with me, some of them, for as long as since 2016, I think, is the longest, and then 2017 or 18, and then a couple in the last 2 years. But yeah, they're just you know, amazing musicians, and I love playing with them. So, you know, going to do this album, there was nobody I really wanted to record with more, even though we just had done shows up until that point. I was really keen to bring these songs to life with them. You know, I feel like I've just gotten really lucky in the sense that, you know, they know exactly when to, you know, sometimes, you know, when you're playing a song, especially when you're playing an original, you might try to overplay, you know, you might do too much guitar parts or try to be too technical on the drums or too many crazy organ riffs or whatever. And, you know, finding the balance of all of that is so hard, I find. You know, I've played with so many people, some really great musicians, and sometimes it's all about the instincts you've got when you're doing those parts, and they've just all got such great instincts when to come in, when to play heavier, when to pull back, and that's worth its weight in gold, you know.
I think with your stuff too, Jordan, because of your lyric content, you need a lot of space around those words, and that's the hardest thing in a musician is what you don't play.
Just absolutely.
Yeah, I like that concept. I like that concept of letting the song breathe, you know, because that's the real sense of what I hear in the work that you put out. So there's space, there's it's crafted. It's, yeah, and you're letting the song breathe, absolutely. So, all right. So part two, Braggy.
Part two. Okay.
All right. So when we, Brixton. When
we, yeah.
Ukulele,
teach us bass. Skip it. After my junior schooling, I enrolled at Bromley Technical High School, where I studied art, music, and design. It was there I formed my first band, the Conrads, in 1962 at the age of 15. Playing guitar, bass, rock and roll at local youth gatherings and weddings, the Conrads had a varying lineup of between 4 and 8 members and were a decent band but didn't have the same aspirations as me. So I left and joined another band, the King Bees. I wrote to the newly successful washing machine entrepreneur John Bloom and invited him to do for us what Brian Epstein had done for the Beatles and make another million. Bloom did not respond to the offer. But his referral to Dick James' partner, Leslie Conn, led to my first personal management contract. Conn quickly began to promote me. My debut single, Liza Jane, credited to me and the King Bees, was not commercially successful. I quit the band less than a month later and joined the Manish Boys, another blues outfit who incorporated folk and soul. We released a cover of Bobby Bland's I Pity the Fool. It was no more successful than Liza Jane. And I I soon moved on again to join the Lower Third, and then again to a band called The Buzz, and then again to a band called The Riot Squad. In 1967, I released a solo single, The Laughing Gnome. This is where Rossi gets it. It also failed to chart, and the follow-up self-titled album, an amalgam of psychedelia and music hall, met the same fate. It did, however, mark the beginning of my working relationship with producer Tony Visconti, which, with large gaps, lasted for the rest of my career. As soon as I said the Conrads, Rossi got it, I reckon.
Yeah. Then you said the Lower Third. Okay,
so we'll keep it under wraps and we'll finish it off, because everybody will get it with the first two lines of the last section.
Excellent. So, Jordan, you've toured a fair bit. So tell us about some of the touring that you've done and the live gigs.
Yeah, honestly, I wish I could have done a bit more touring. I've mainly done sort of, between, the sunny coast up to Melbourne, that sort of circuit. But unfortunately, just as I was gearing up to do, I suppose more states and shows, the pandemic hit. So I was sort of, my plans are sort of thrown a curveball. But I got to say that just being able to experience, I'll never forget the first time I got to fly to Melbourne and play, and it was about a crowd of 10 people, but it was just such an amazing experience, Even if there's 10 people and 5 of them were family, you just think, wow, I can't believe I'm playing in a foreign city for the first time. It's such a great moment. And then, doing, plenty of shows in Melbourne after that, building up a crowd, and same with Sydney, Brisbane, the Gold Coast, Sunny Coast, all the sort of cities, Byron, of course, as well. So many great cities to play. I definitely would love to do more touring, and that's something that I sort of was hoping to do this year, but was just honestly so busy planning it, the release of the album, to, find time to book shows, and then by the time you go to do it, it's the album's out in a month. So, I sort of got myself on the spot.
Your name's on the door and you've got so much work to do.
Yeah, gosh, it doesn't stop, does it? When you're self-managed, independent artist that also works a full-time job, you're managing a lot, So little bits and pieces.
Whereabouts in Sydney did you play when you were down here? Where have you played in Sydney?
So I've played a couple of venues. I've played the Gasoline Pony a bunch. Gasoline Pony. I've done the Factory Theatre 3 times, which has been good. And I did play I played Oxford Art Factory.
Okay.
That's good. Well. Yeah, that was good, great. Good. That was the one and only band show I've done in Sydney. It was great, but extremely costly. So we, we'll do it again in a few years, and it's been a good few years since that. But no, that was just my.
Someone else picked up the tab. Get someone else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but no, I love Sydney. It's funny. I you know, when I moved to Brisbane was meant to be more of a stopgap getting to Melbourne. You know, I think a lot of young artists think, oh, Melbourne's the city to be for music, and it's still I think it's an incredible city for music, don't get me wrong, but I think the Brisbane music scene is just completely underrated. I think it's there's so much talent here, but yeah, Sydney, I gotta say, I my first experience at Sydney was Oxford Art Factory, and it was great, but it was also just so chaotic that I thought, oh, I don't think I'll ever, like, maybe Sydney's not going to be my favorite place to play. But then it's funny how things work. Over the pandemic, it was pretty much one of the only places I could go interstate and play for whatever reason. I don't know why. Oh, obviously, Melbourne was on lockdown for forever, I'd seen. But so I kept going back to Sydney, and I played the Sydney, I think, yeah, three times over the, actually, every show at the, Factory Theatre. Yeah, so I did three shows over the pandemic at Factory Theatre. Sorry, two over the pandemic and one this year. And yeah, just Sydney just grew on me, honestly. I just kept wanting to book more shows there and come back. There's definitely a great scene there, and I don't think I probably appreciated it as much with that first show at Oxford Art Factory. But I mean, to be fair, it was a pretty crazy show. We were playing probably more quiet and folky blues music back then, and next in the large room next door was Hockey Dad. So if you've heard, I'd play an acoustic number and you just hear in the background. It was it was a weird gig, but great experience, great venue outside of that though.
Tell me about Fugitive and the Vagabond.
Yeah, well, that was with them. So that was the Oxford Art Factory show. So, yeah, no, that was my first band. It was still sort of, I suppose it was like a solo project that sort of morphed into a band. I sort of, when I started off, I wanted to have a band name and not play under my own name. And, yeah, the band sort of formed, just sort of met people when I moved to Brisbane, and the band sort of got together and did the one album, and pretty much recorded an EP that then got parked. There's sometimes, you know, life gets in the way, then the pandemic hit, and then by that stage it's sort of been well into doing solo stuff, and we all sort of went our separate ways. So yeah, it was a bit of a shame that it didn't sort of continue, but it was, you know, I love my time in the band. It was you know, my first real experience doing band things, and I think as well, you know, like having to coordinate recordings and gigs and promo, I was learning so much in that time. It was a good couple of years.
Do you like playing solo though? Do you do that still?
Yeah, I do. I sort of do a bit of a mix of the two. I think they're both, I love them both, and I think they've both got great aspects to it, like playing solo and playing with the band. I think with playing solo, particularly when you dive into folk songs, you know, I think it's, you know, for me, every time I do those sort of shows, I always like to do them in, you know, like small intimate venues. I think they're the if you get a good room where everyone's sort of quiet listening, and you have some, you know, talking throughout the show, and I love that. Like, that for me is just so much fun, and it's such a great way to connect with people. I've, like, as a crowd member, I love those sort of shows. Playing them, they're great. With a band though, I just think they're just so much fun. You still connect, and I think when you connect playing as a band, I feel like it's a lot more tribal, if you will, you know, than the playing and the sharing of a story. It's like you're sharing a moment, you know. I think as well, because my band is just such great people, I love playing with them. And then you know, when you can just vibe off each other and then off the crowd, and you're all sort of getting into it, acting like fools, dancing and singing, and it's nothing like it. It's so much fun. It's the most fun you can have, I think.
Yeah, it's extra, isn't it? Because like solo, it's kind of you projecting to the crowd, and you're getting feedback from them. But as soon as there's more people there, then you guys start connecting as well, which and the crowd realize that and they see that as well. And it's just, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They're both great. But the energy is the best.
It's important to torment your fellow band members when you're on stage.
Like coming off the top rope, Curly.
That's right.
Oh yeah. If you're that way inclined, of course.
If you like to come off the turnbuckle,
they just never know what's going to go on.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jordan, you've got some good numbers on Spotify.
It's massive numbers. Yeah, actually.
Thanks. Cheers. Yeah.
I was reading, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know, you guys might know better than me, that Spotify next year because they pay so greatly for each stream.
Anything under a thousand,
you do not get paid for. I don't think they take it. Yeah, they don't take it off Spotify, but you just don't get any money for it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I think there's, I sort of get why to an extent. I mean, if they're trying to funnel money into the higher stream songs and whatever, but I mean, the money you make from 1,000 streams anyways, is you wouldn't even cover a tenth of your registration fee for that song. So,
I'm going to lose.
Yeah, God, $1.45 for 1,000 streams. That sounds like excessive to me. I like streaming. It's great, you know, when you're walking to the station to go to work, you put on your headphones and listen to music. That's great. But you know, for me, it's just one of many ways I like to enjoy music. I think the worst thing we can do as a society is make that the only way we can enjoy music. Because I think when you go to shows, it's completely different. You chuck on a record, it's completely different. I think the important thing is, you know, people who like music just need to support more than just streaming, you know, to keep the artist, you know, paid and making music, because otherwise who's paying for the recordings?
Absolutely.
Live shows are the only way artists can make money, and that's through merch sales, physical media sale at gigs, and a little bit of a gig fee or what have you. It's the only way to make money, because the recorded media industry is broken. It really is broken.
That's
a sad bit. So it becomes a loss leader for your live shows.
Absolutely.
And your vinyl is part of your merch now at the gig.
Absolutely.
It's like, as you said, it's you book a show almost just to get the people in the room to sell merch to, you know, from a business side of thing. Like that's you don't really, especially when you consider them, you got to market your shows to sell tickets. Like that's where you make your money back, you know, is through merch more than anything.
In turn, though, your song, because you're on Spotify, your song gets out to all those people in Melbourne or wherever they are, and they, you know, so it's an evil.
People
who know you exist then. It's an integrated strategy.
Yeah, we're still working it out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you got to fill every bucket, not just one, you know, so.
And you get very tired doing it. Very, very tired having you, especially when you've got to go to work in the morning.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You cop it. It's all right. It's wild. We love it.
Do it because you want to.
I hate that.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you've got a good range of merch. I can see you've got a couple of t-shirts, and you do vinyl. That's awesome. We love our vinyl, so that's good to see. That's excellent.
Yeah, you absolutely.
Do as well, or you just do vinyl?
I've got only the first album on CD. I was going to do a CD run for the new album, but to be honest, I sort of put a poll out on social media about, like, do you want a CD? Should I do CDs? And it was overwhelming no. So I was like, well, I'm not paying for that then. So the people have spoken. So
it's a bit of a retro movement amongst the young folk, I believe.
The CD. Oh, really? Yeah. They're coming back. Yeah. They're going to overtake vinyl again. God,
And if someone got, like, I heard some people talking about putting cassettes out. I was going to just punch them.
I know some people have put cassettes out, and I'm just. I just see that and I think, well, at least you can put a CD on in a car still, you know, most cars.
I'll get my pencil out for that cassette.
Yeah, absolutely. And start winding it back up.
My daughter went to this experimental music night here in Adelaide at one of the local pubs, and the guy was doing a DJ set with three cassette players.
Oh my God.
How do you do that?
She said it was awesome. He'd made his own loops. Like they used to do in the old days, with cassette tape.
That's actually what loops are. Tapes. Yeah. People talk about loops. That's actually what they are. It's crazy, isn't it? But it's become ubiquitous and named something else. But tape loops. Love Is in the Air, right? Love Is in the Air. That's a drum loop, right?
Yeah.
And so they just had this giant loop of tape, like brooms up in the room, and like it's swinging around brooms and coming around, right?
Oh my God.
Anyway, before we get too distracted, I will make sure, Jordan, your links are in the show notes. And Braggy, this is part number 3, and this is hopefully where Curly gets it.
Oh, Curly, you'll get it. Don't worry about that.
You got it.
Feeling alienated over my unsuccessful music career and deeply affected by a breakup with my then girlfriend, Hermione Farthingale, great name, I wrote a song about a fictional astronaut named Major Tom. The song earned me, I'll finish it up. The song earned me a contract with Mercury Records and its subsidiary Philips, who issued Space Oddity as a single on the 11th of July, 1969, 5 days before the Apollo 11 launch. What timing that was. Reaching the top 5 in the UK, it was my first and last hit for 3 years. Having studied dramatic arts under Lindsay Kemp, the famous British dancer and mime artist, and with an ever-increasing interest in avant-garde theatre, I immersed myself in the creation of a persona to present to the world. Dressed in a striking costume, my hair dyed reddish-brown, I launched my Ziggy Stardust stage show with the Spiders from Mars at the Toby Jug Pub in Tolworth in Kensington-upon-Thames on 10th of February 1972. The show was hugely popular, catapulted me to stardom. My songs and stagecraft brought a new dimension to popular music. One of the founders of glam rock, I also inspired the innovators of punk rock and am credited with bringing sophistication to rock music in general. The BBC's art editor once likened me to Pablo Picasso as an innovative, visionary, and restless artist who synthesized complex avant-garde concepts into beautifully coherent works that touch the hearts and minds of millions. Mm. My name is
Davy Jones.
That was his real name too. David Bowie.
David Bowie. Well done, Braggy. That was
a good one.
Excellent work.
The thing I take out of that is the guy tried everything and he couldn't fucking make it, and then he gets a broken heart and writes
a song.
Writes a song about solitude, guy out in space. That's how lonely he is.
Yeah.
I love the bit when he became Ziggy Stardust, the bear were all these northern blokes, these really hard northern blokes. He's brought them down and he goes, all right, we're wearing makeup. And they're going, no, we won't be doing that. And then they do a couple of shows and all the girls turn up and they're going, oh, can I have your eyeliner?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He says he went backstage and they're fighting over who gets the eyeliner.
Unreal. That's a good one, Braggy. So, Jordan, what's next for you?
Yeah, so I got a couple of shows left to finish the year up. So I just got a show on the Goldie in a couple of weeks and then one more in Brizzy at It's Still a Secret, which will be good. And then, yeah, just taking a bit of a break over Chrissy. And, I think the first thing I'm going to do when I have a break is just sort of have a bit of a social media cleanse and take some time just to, you know, put the phone down and spend some time at the beach or camping, just sort of get away from technology for a bit, you know, and then work out what the hell to do next year, pretty much. So... I'm not planning that far ahead this year. It's sort of taking it easy.
I need a man who does what he's told, who wants to hold my hand, knows when to let go. I need a man who ain't scared of a fight, who takes what he wants, doesn't care what is right. If push comes to shove, the man knows what I need. I need a man.
Sounds like another typical weekend at Braggy's place. So put the phone down, think about what to do. Go to the beach.
I don't go to the beach. Hey, you know what? There's even when you have a break though, Jordan, isn't there? There's a song somewhere. You know, you found one.
Absolutely.
You found one in a painting. So no matter what, some people think you got to travel to find songs, but they lurk everywhere.
Yeah, you honestly, it's amazing, really. And I think it's just about, you know, acknowledging the thoughts that are actually, you know, I'll refer to your wife's favorite singer, Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
About how he once said, I can't remember the exact line, but it was something about how he sort of hears the songs in the wind and then he's got to quickly write them down before the breeze has taken them away. That was his analogy. And I remember saying that, and you know, you think that's a bit foxy. That's a classic musician thing to say. Yeah. But then you start to really get into songwriting and you're walking along and just a line will come to you, just a little thought will come to you, and you just acknowledge it, quickly write it down, then it becomes a song, you know. The painting just turns into a poem, and God, most of my songs are written in weird moments, and it's not all. I used to try to be really like efficient with my writing. I could sit down to write a song, but I can't count the number of times songs that are on the three albums and the EPs that literally came from not being near a guitar, that just sort of came from thinking in random spots. Mm-hmm. You know, it's crazy how that works. And it's like that. It's like the breeze. You just have to listen for it. If something comes up, you've just got to know that you need to take that down and don't forget it.
Yeah.
And if you do that and you get into the habit of doing that, you never lose inspiration, because it just doesn't stop, you know. You can't avoid it. So.
Yeah. And I guess so when you haven't got your guitar, because you pick up your guitar, you gravitate to the same chords and the same things a lot of the time. Don't you?
Yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah.
I'm a G man myself.
Straight to the A minor, honestly.
So when you haven't got the guitar, you come up with melodies that you would never come because you're just thinking of them in your head.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about the melody, honestly. When you're not physically picking up the guitar, it definitely allows. I think that's as well important. Like even if I'm writing with a guitar, I'll often try to write the melody and then work out the keys in and then the chords.
Yeah.
You know, all doing that at once is you try your best, but I think it's important to always start with that melody, you know, because the chords have been used a trillion times, you know. You can't write an original chord progression. It's just not possible, but you can come up with original stories and original melodies, and that's the important stuff, you know. Yeah. The chords, you can't plagiarize a chord progression. It's just not possible these days. It's already been done. Everything's plagiarism in that way, so you can't worry about that. It's just all about finding your own unique touch to it.
Yeah.
That's it. Well said.
100%. Jordan, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show there this evening. One of the joys of our job is getting to hear new music and talk to people putting out that new music. And there's not a day go by that I don't look forward to our Wednesday nights when we get to do that with two of the best blokes I know in music, Rossi and Braggy, and talking with some and talking to someone like yourself who's just so enthusiastic and putting out some really good stuff and has got a really clear, and you know, in another world they call it branding, but you've got a really clear aspect of what your music is all about, and that's just inspirational, not just to people who love music, but for people really wanting to make a difference. I'll make sure that the songs that we featured tonight in the episode will go on the Unfiltered and Undiscovered playlist in Spotify. I think we're now, we'll be at about 297 songs. So we're getting close to that magic 300 mark, Braggy.
You need to put I Need a Man on there too, Curly.
Yeah, I Need a Man. That'll like go that on there.
Too. My wife likes that song too.
Yeah, okay. Oh, good.
We'll do. We'll do. So we'll make sure that goes on there. We'll make sure Jordan's links are in the show notes. And of course, if you've enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, leave a review if you can. I'm back. Yeah, Braggy's back. I thought we'd lost him. We're on YouTube, Facebook, TikTok. Check out our website at unfilteredundiscovered.com. Enjoy our playlist. We've got the Fresh and Fierce Female playlist, which is all our favorite female country artists that we've had on. And, of course, we've got the Unfiltered and Undiscovered playlist. Lyrics from the playlist today comes from one of my favorite bands back in the 80s, the Lime Spiders. And it's simply, let me tell you about a girl I know. I'll see you all. Thanks, Jordan. Thanks, Rossi. Thanks Braggy. Guys. And we'll see everyone next week.
See you guys.
Bye for now.
The Stone Age with me.